The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Chris Ludeman. He serves as Global President of Capital Markets, SCBRE Group. And he joins us by phone today from Dallas, Texas, to discuss a new report he promulgated about global capital flows for real estate investment. Chris Ludeman, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate you taking the time, and you know, the headline for our listeners, the reason I got in touch with Chris about getting together by phone here is the headline on CBRE's latest Global Capital Flows research paper read, Middle East investors spend $10.1 billion on global real estate during the past 12 months. And we want to dive into that as well as capital flows from other regions of the world. So, Chris, let's start there. What is the attraction to U.S. real estate among Middle Eastern investors? Some of this is obvious to maybe a few of our listeners, but we don't want to assume that. And what Middle Eastern countries are the two or three biggest players in terms of the amount of capital they commit to U.S. real estate over this past year?
Certainly. I would say, not surprisingly to most of your listeners, the attraction to the United States for all offshore investors, including Middle Eastern investors, would be the relative strength and predictability of our economy, a rule of law that actually is that perhaps we take for granted, and the transparency of information and the availability of information that makes decision-making far less opaque than in many parts of the world. Sometimes we recognize that we as a company, a country, and an industry have our challenges, but as you travel the world and recognize those same circumstances around the world, the United States is a predictable and safe haven with still upside and opportunity.
You know, I always find this interesting because transparency is something, as you say, that we offer in a big way, as well as other westernized democracies. But the U.S. and Australia, I think, in particular, are very good about that. And the Middle Eastern investors like that, but their own societies are not at all transparent. So they see the virtue in transparency, but at the same time, in their own countries, it doesn't appear that they push the government to adopt rules of transparency that enhance their feeling of security and where they're putting their money. Maybe their own backyard there is transparent because these are some powerful players. And then I don't know about legal redress in the event that something goes wrong, whether the Middle Eastern countries we're talking about have strong legal redress remedies or not. But don't you find that just a little bit curious that our way of life is an attraction for those investors, but it's kind of antithetical to their way of life?
Well, certainly, and that's one of the reasons that these investors try to diversify their investments and their cash flows. But that opaqueness and that uncertainty probably depends on it's really the Middle East is a big place. And if you think about all the country, I think we have a tendency to look at that as a broad category. So many would say the United States. Well, the United States has a lot of places and cities and states and within the Union. So does the Middle East. So if you think about Iraq, Lebanon, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, Qatar, and Israel. And there you got Israel in the middle of a lot of other different kinds of countries. So it's a very colorful patchwork of countries that make up the Middle East, and each of them are slightly different. And as your readers and your listeners will remember and know, we've had a lot of news of late with political change in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, it's still a monarchy, and you still have the wealth of the country controlled by a relative few participants, and so that changes the dynamic in terms of transparency in and of itself. But where Israel is quite is more like a United States democracy on either end of that spectrum.
So what about what countries in the Middle East are maybe 1, 2, and 3 in terms of their real estate investments in the U.S. over the past year?
Well, we often think of places that get big trophy properties like the Saudis and the Qataris, but really the number one investor, certainly in the last 4 quarters from the Middle East and into the United States, has been Israel by almost a factor of over 2.
Wow.
So where they've invested $2.5 billion in the U.S. In the last 4 quarters, somebody like the Qataris are at just a tick over $1 billion, followed by the Kuwaitis at 750 million.
Interesting. So let me ask you this. Israeli investors, is it strictly diversification, or is it that Israel is a very small country with not a lot of real estate, investable real estate stock? Is that part of what's driving some of those dollars ashore or offshore?
Israel, that would fall into that category. It's a very astute observation that if you think about the relative size of Israel, and by population, I'm going to be generally right, specifically wrong, I think it's like 6 or 8 million people. And when you have 6 or 8 million people and you look at the investable stock, it's very hard to, you have a relatively few that control a lot, or very difficult for individual investors to participate in markets. So Israeli investors typically will be seeking greater yields, and the yield profile for Israeli investors is usually higher than many others in the Middle East, and they will venture into secondary and tertiary cities to obtain that yield, where many of the larger sovereign wealth funds, as an example from the region, will tend to stay in the gateway cities, both in the United States and around the world.
Now, that's interesting. I was going to ask you about
that. They're often looking for different levels of risk as well. Different levels of risk will also drive those investor pools.
Why is it that Israel feels comfortable going to the secondary and tertiary markets, where my understanding is one of the aversions to those markets is that a lot of times if you lose a major anchor in, an office building, it's hard to replace that because they just don't have the business base that a New York or Los Angeles or Chicago has got. So what is it about their philosophy of investing that makes them comfortable with those secondary and tertiary markets? Is it anything that can be identified?
First of all, many Israelis have deep contacts within the United States and in many of these communities in which they invest, so they have a comfort in those markets that perhaps someone from afar may not, from someone else in the region may not. Secondly, they're more risk tolerant. Thirdly, there is a misnomer that some of these smaller markets are not as stable. In fact, if you look at recent studies that we've done about suburban office assets around the United States, the actual volatility in the rent rolls in suburban office environments around the country in the United States have actually been, over time, more stable. What isn't as dynamic are pricing fluctuations relative to cap rates. So there's not as big a beta there, so you really are looking for property level performance and consistent cash flows, where you may not have, you know, the valuations having a beta where you could buy in theory at a 6 cap and sell at a 5 cap, or buy at a 7 cap and sell at a 4 cap. So those are one of the reasons that Israelis are looking for steady, predictable cash flows and yields, perhaps above what others would pay, and they're willing to go further afield to get them.
Now, the other Middle Eastern countries that you mentioned, are the dollars flowing out of sovereign wealth funds? Does Israel have a sovereign wealth fund? Are the dollars coming from Israel from individual investors and real estate companies? I've never actually heard of a Israeli sovereign wealth fund, but that doesn't really mean anything. Where do the dollars come from in Israel vis-a-vis the other Middle Eastern players?
Usually from individuals, ultra and high net worth individuals, family offices, lots of syndication that goes on where someone in the United States who is very well connected and has raised capital for funds in Israel will present an opportunity, and oftentimes that'll be syndicated with individuals and entities within Israel. So most of it is not akin to, for instance, Abu Dhabi, where there's very large, like Adias and Addicts and others that are more pension fund oriented.
So the number two and three countries again over the past year were, I didn't retain that, Chris. So who's number two and three?
Qatar and Kuwait. Typically, those kinds of entities are looking at larger trophy-type assets and that may be more brochure quality, now offering both prestige and hopefully stability of cash flows. What we've seen in the last 12 months and say 4 to 6 quarters is a modest movement in from the risk spectrum. So the stable long-term cash flow supported by credit quality of most of the or large parts of the tenant stack is the most attractive, whereas an asset that is noteworthy.
Sovereign wealth funds are the big players in those two countries. Is that the case, Chris?
Yeah, you have KIC, you have you do have sovereign wealth funds out of that region that have been very, very active investors, as well as ultra-high net worth investors. So they are often, the distance between the two in some of these countries is not as wide as one might think.
You know, what's interesting, certainly in the case of Qatar or Qatar or Qatar, however you want to pronounce it, it's pronounced so many different ways, they are right now, basically being embargoed by their neighbors. They're under a lot of threat because the political situation is such that there's a feeling that they're cozying up to Iran, a deadly enemy of Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so on. I'm wondering, is that threat, and then take Kuwait, which is bordered by Iran and Iraq, and now you're talking about the Shia-Sunni confrontation. Are those two nations, does that have any bearing on the decision to start offshoring more of these investment dollars, or is this kind of par for the course? Did they invest as much over the last year as they did previous years, or was this a major uptick?
Well, as a region, the region has actually invested less. They've kind of gone back to, say, 2013 to 2014 levels of investment. And there's a story around each of those. So, for instance, as the price of oil, particularly for those countries and areas that generate a lot of their revenue through petrodollars, as that has fallen, that's put a lot more pressure on their economy. So the sovereign wealth funds may be actually have been less active, but still active than they had in the past because they didn't feel they felt like they had to be more conservative and keep capital closer to home. Whereas higher net worth and individuals who had amassed capital may be ever more vigilant about trying to diversify and preserve wealth as in addition to getting yield, and they may be moving in opposite directions. So, as you look at the participants in the market, they ebb and flow based upon things like the cost of oil in that region. Doesn't mean that oil may be less expensive, and that may mean they're investing less in commercial real estate than they would have at $90 oil or $100 oil. They're still investing. They're still trying to diversify their revenue streams into different alternatives, of which real estate is one. Allocations have typically been higher, but there may be a rebalancing that we actually saw happen in places like with the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, ADIA, in the last couple of years. That doesn't mean they've gone away. They're still very, very committed to commercial real estate as an alternative, and they'll be back. But you'll see many high net worth individuals now working to further hedge their risk on their investments by moving more capital out of their country of origin into what they believe to be a safer haven. And the United States can offer that.
So the $10.1 billion is by no means a record. In fact, it's a lower amount than some previous years, the capital flow from the Middle East. What I'm curious about is the targeting of this money. What are their favorite U.S. targets? Are they the obvious ones? Now, you mentioned Israel has been going to secondary and tertiary markets. What about Qatar and Kuwait?
Well, you'll see them generally, particularly at the institutional level, still focused on the large markets. If you were to say, and remember, sometimes it can create one deal can be a big number in New York or London, and so consequently, you believe all of that capital from that region is going to, in a preponderance of intention, to one market or two markets. But large deals in New York can be $1 billion to $2 billion, and that can be kind of a one and done philosophy. So if you were to look at statistically where in the United States, I think is your question, where most of that money went, and then I can, if you're interested, I can kind of opine on what kind of products it went into. But if you were to look at the five largest recipients of inbound capital in the last 12 months, you'd start with New York, followed by Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Boston. Not a big surprise. All considered gateway or relative gateway heavyweight markets. But if you look then down the stack beyond that, and then that starts to look at the kinds of products that some of these investors are investing, all of a sudden you see names like Cincinnati, Miami, Atlanta, Milwaukee, Columbus, Denver, Memphis. So, but a lot of these are, for instance, in Milwaukee, I'm looking at a number there. I think that was a sale leaseback of a big corporate headquarters. And so why would that be attractive to a Middle East investor? High-quality tenant with good credit in a good building, willing to sign a long-term lease that provides stable, predictable cash flow. Other products that have been increasingly of interest, because we all assume that office is always the preferred place of investment for Middle Eastern capital and other lots of times foreign capital. But we've seen multifamily really take a bump up in the last number of years because now it's an asset class in the Middle East that people have come to understand. It's not one that's prevalent in their countries, but now they understand it. And for certain Middle Eastern investors, it's Sharia compliant because you don't have certain lending institutions or services such as alcohol that might dissuade some investors from the Middle East. And the other, of course, has been the interest in industrial and logistics. And as you put a long-term lease on an Amazon warehouse, for instance, that Amazon has these things built by developers. They sign 10 to 15 year leases. Amazon has got a good credit quality. So you can clip those things off at $100 to $120 million, and it's like buying a bond with some ups. So all of a sudden, some of these other product types, and student housing and senior housing, more so student housing, have greater appeal, as well as healthcare. But those are probably and usually smaller ticket sizes, not inconsequential, but it takes a lot of $100 million deals or $50 million deals to equate to a $1 billion deal.
Let's take a trip to some other parts of the world here. How does the capital flow into real estate investments over the past year from the Middle East compare with capital flows from Europe and Asia?
Well, I would maybe it would be helpful to say who from extraordinarily active in the United States and doing a spike a couple of places out. First and foremost among them would be German capital that has been very active in both the primary and secondary cities in the United States. And if you say, why might that be? Well, if you look at the bond market in Germany and the 10-year bond as an example and compare it to ours, those bond yields in Germany are next to nothing. So as that money comes in, and these, remember, we have a global savings glut. So as individuals put money into pension plans or open-ended retail funds, that needs to be placed. And so they can afford, if they're promising those investors something like 2% in Germany, they can, even with hedging costs, they can go out and produce, buy good quality, long-term, credit-enhanced assets at 4 to 5% and still produce the kind of returns that those investors want. Now, they do hedge, but they only hedge their equity, so then they'll put leverage, and so they can produce those returns to satisfy their investors, as an example. If you move to the other side of the world, we spent a lot of time in the last few years remarking about how active the Chinese have been. But we've read a lot, and certainly I've experienced in being in the region the last couple of weeks, capital controls are real for a variety of different reasons. So the Chinese are much more conservative despite outlier transactions and may be looking to repatriate capital back into China. If the money's not already circulating outside of China, it's much more difficult for Chinese capital to get out. But if you pivot to places like Korea, South Korea, Korean investors have been very active in the United States in both equity and debt investments. And so you almost have to look at things on a country-by-country basis, and they will ebb and flow. An example of that is, generally, I think Korean investors thought the United States was pretty pricey in the last several years and that the yields that they were getting in the United States were perhaps too narrow. So they were moving more equity investments to, say, Europe, where they felt that there could be greater returns on a relative risk-adjusted basis. And the Koreans decided to be lenders in the United States. So they raised capital and deployed that through various tranches in the lending stack. But now fast forward to present time, they've had a more difficult time getting as much capital out as they had desired, and certainly at rates that they thought they would achieve given the proliferation of debt funds in the United States. There's probably 50 of them now. And when they started this strategy, there were certainly far fewer of them.
And in terms of property types or product, Chris, is there a difference between European, Asian, and Middle Eastern investors with in terms of their preferences?
Yes, I would. In general, if you look at our international investors' intentions, office has historically been the number one product type of interest to international investors. That has now been supplanted by industrial logistics, which is not just for foreign investors, but also U.S. investors as well. And that would suggest, with the continued expansion of e-commerce and the challenges that some retail concepts have experienced, and the direct-to-consumer sort of appeal through an e-commerce solution, well, I'll tell you, industrial is hot as a pistol. But what you generally see with most institutional investors, they start relatively conservatively. And by that, they will, if they haven't been invested, and we'll, maybe if we have time, I can opine on what's happening in Japan and the changes in Japan. But what they'll generally start is, it's a logical progression. They want to know about a market, so they may, a market or a product type, and they might invest in a well-known, high-quality REIT, whether it's in an office REIT in a specific market, dominance in New York, or in a firm like Prologis that is a great industrial and developer and operator throughout the world. They get to know that product type, and then they become more direct. They may now allocate funds and give it to an investment manager through a strategy. There is a commingled fund around a specific strategy or in a separate account. Get a little more educated, and as they get more confident, they may start to invest in joint ventures at the property level as opposed to in a pooled plan level. And with some, they all of a sudden say, well, I'm going to buy an operating company, and I'm going to be a direct investor. So it's been fascinating to watch the ebb and flow of that kind of investment activity.
Tell us about what's going on in Japan.
So as you may recall, the Japanese were very, very active in the United States in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, and they were very aggressive investors in U.S. real estate, and it appeared that they, at that time, and I was in the business at that time, what do they know that we don't? Because they were certainly being able to pay prices for real estate that most domestic investors didn't understand. Well, that didn't come to a particularly wonderful end for the Japanese. And actually, the ability of Japanese pension plans to invest outside of Japan were severely constrained. There's now been a change in the law, and if you look at the two largest pension plans in Japan, GPIF and Japan Post, each has decided that they are now going to, and these are pension plans with well over $1 trillion in assets under management, they are now going to create modest, by percentage basis, allocations to commercial real estate and outside of Japan, but you know, 3-5% modest allocation to real estate against a base of well over $1 trillion. It's a lot of money. So what you're going to find with those Japanese pension plans, they will now choose managers, and they'll be investing indirectly through investment managers in selected strategies. So I would suspect that if they continue to go according to plan, people like GPIF will start to show up, their influence will start to show up in the United States in, say, the third or fourth quarter of 2018, although they may be fronted by well-known investment management companies, but the capital will be Japanese. To give you a frame of reference with GPIF, with this well over, I think it's $1.4 trillion of assets under management, they only have 15 executives dedicated to alternatives. That's something outside of stocks and bonds. Only five are focused on real estate globally. So they need the help of, they don't have the scale of people, so they need the help of strong investment managers and advisors.
Interesting.
Also, what will happen in Japan is, I spent week in Japan 2 weeks ago, and the appetite by Japanese investors and development companies for U.S. real estate from development as opposed to build. So what they really want to do is develop to create yield as opposed to have someone else do that for them, and they buy into that yield. That's not all people and all things, but you're going to see a lot more Japanese development capital coming into the United States as well.
You know, I have
the big trading companies.
I have to believe, Chris, that the Japanese real estate investors of the 1980s and the lenders look back and realize that if they hadn't panicked, if they had been more patient and rode out the big collapse there, they would have done extremely well. I mean, do you hear any of that now?
Well, the Japanese are very proud and smart people, and they are students of both their successes and their challenges. And you are most likely right, but it took a long time for the scar tissue that they experienced to kind of dissipate. But I think that time has come and now has passed. So they feel more confident. They've learned from both their successes and their failures and how they want to do it this time. But generally, as they move forward, it will be in more core-like strategies with less beta in them. And so the real question is, as we move through this cycle, both domestically and with foreign investors, is there going to be enough core product as we get more mature in the cycle? There may be more aversion to risk, but will there be enough core product to satisfy the demand that capital has for it, which then suggests what core product is offered to the market will continue to be sold at high prices and low yields?
So we do see prices getting pumped up, these dollars flowing, and are really good for price inflation on U.S. real estate, particularly in the gateway tier one markets. So what about that? Is it getting to a level now that some foreign investors are saying it's just a little too pricey? Or do you think, has it not reached that point yet? And secondarily, I'm wondering if we might start to see more countries than just Israel look to secondary and tertiary markets more favorably.
Well, you've made a very good observation again. What we've seen with foreign capital as the gateway markets have been, I'm just going to use an overused term, priced to more closer to perfection, and recognizing in many of the gateway markets, you can't do bite size unless you're buying partial interests in very large pieces of property. So we've already seen a movement to dynamic welterweight second tier cities that have good job growth, demographics, smart populations. So where real smart capital is going is where real smart people are, and the cities that are growing at rates above the national average, where there may be a 75 to 150 basis point investing advantage, so the cap rates for the best product in, say, Dallas or Denver may be wide of an equivalent product in New York or Boston or San Francisco by 100 to 150 basis points, yet the credit quality is just as good. The quality of the assets are terrific or typically strong. And they can take more measured bites of investment.
So you've already given us some coming attractions there, or some, a little bit of prognostication. So let's go to the near term here, Chris. We're just about to tip over into 2018. What are the prospects for foreign capital flows into the United States during the next year in 2018? Are you expecting it to be as robust as this year? Is it going to be higher? Is it going to be lower? I know guys in the business oftentimes don't like to make predictions, but what do the indicators say?
Provided the United States economy continues to press forward with positive growth in the 2-3% or better economic expansion, I would expect that foreign capital will invest at or even above the levels of this past year. Now, this year, a couple of things have happened in 2017. The Chinese are a lot less active, and they were a meaningful part of the marketplace in the last 3 years, meaning 16, 15, 14 as an example. Now, we've also seen a meaningful amount of political change in Saudi Arabia, and we've been reading about that, and I've seen it on the news where a lot of ultra-high-net-worth individuals have now had their wings clipped a little bit, and that's creating some uncertainty and doubt. So the Saudis may be a bit less active until that settles down, at least at the private investment around the world. But the PIF, the Saudi Arabian pension plan, I would expect to be quite active. So the short answer is we expect the same to slightly more investment activity in the United States. And keep in mind, there's a lot of uncertainty around the world. So as we get further into 2018, things will be either murkier or clearer about Brexit and the impact in Europe. So all of those things suggest that while we are far from perfect in the United States on a relative basis, it's a pretty good place to invest with safety and security.
So, Chris, before I let you go, and I don't know if you have these figures right in front of you, I've been quoting 10.1 billion capital flows from the Middle East. If you add up capital flows from around the world into the United States during 2017, what's that total roughly?
I don't have it at the top of my head, but here's something that I think is, and we can follow up with that, and I can get that to you if it continues to be interesting after this call. I should know that's top of my head. But here's the other thing, and I think when you look at these third-party studies about the amount of capital that's flowing into the United States, and some would say it's 10 to 13% of the overall volume. If it's 10% on easy numbers, and if we're doing $450 billion, that's $45 billion. But what is not captured is when many of these assets trade, if it's being traded in the name that is attributed to the trade is an investment manager like a Clarion or CBRE Global Investors or REEF or Deutsche Asset Management. Some people don't really recognize that they're doing that on either a separate account or commingled basis where a lot of the investors in those funds are non-domestics. So the actual impact of foreign capital into the United States, in my guesstimation, is probably much closer to 20 to 25% if you could see through who's behind each of those transactions. Now, it would take a little bit of time to prove that concept out, but when you really understand who's investing in these closed-end funds or how the amount of separate accounts, it's profound.
Now, when you say 25%, are you talking about 25% of the total dollars being invested you suspect are coming from overseas, or are you saying 25% more than we actually are tracking right now are coming from overseas?
No, I would say if I were to be out on a limb, which is an always dangerous place to be, particularly if the limb gets thin, and if I gain too much weight, I would say it's probably at least twice what's stated in public reporting, because it's very difficult to get into the numbers of and see whose capital is being invested that we may believe is being invested by a domestic investment manager, as an example, but not really seeing that the capital that they're fiduciary for is foreign. So my guess is probably two times what's being reported.
Wow, that is...
And the last thing that you should keep an eye on is that what would be the impact of the elimination of FERPTA? You mentioned earlier, we talked earlier in the conversation about the Japanese, and most don't know that FERPTA was created in the late 70s, early 80s by Congress because the Japanese there was a great fear that the Japanese would be buying up most of the best farmland in the United States, and that it would take that farmland out of domestic ownership. And heretofore, before that time, when that stuff was traded, there was no taxation. So they tried to create a mechanism that would make investment in the United States less attractive because creating a much more punitive tax on the profits associated with FERPTA. Now, the unintended consequence of that is it really sort of moved through that law was enacted by Congress and signed by the president, actually then impacted all sorts of different types of real estate, not just farmland. So that's why you see so many more foreign investors, particularly pension plans, that may only invest in up to 49% because they don't want to trigger control because it changes the level of taxation. Now, Chairman Brady of the House Ways and Means Committee in the Congress has stated publicly that one of his goals during this term of Congress, which who knows whether that could happen, would be to fully eliminate FERPTA. And if FERPTA goes away and the investment environment becomes more an equal playing field or a level playing field, what you're going to see then is a lot, I would project, a lot more foreign capital coming to the United States. Now, the probability of that happening to me is less than 50%, and certainly in this Congress, but at least it's being talked about more regularly.
You know, I'm actually old enough to remember when there was this panic, the xenophobia going on at the time because Japanese money was flowing in. They were buying trophy properties, and I believe at the time it was pointed out that the Canadians were actually buying more property than the Japanese, but nobody was having a problem with that. And there was even fear that the Japanese were going to make a play for Disney, try to buy it, at which point it was made clear that the U.S. government would identify that as a national treasure and just block that kind of a sale, which, you know, that actually...
Well, it started in the heartlands. It started in the farms. And then it went out from there. But you're absolutely right. It started in the farms.
Like the Japanese, hopefully we have learned from our successes and our failures, although sometimes it doesn't feel that way. Our guest has been Chris Ludeman. He is Global President of Capital Markets at CBRE, and we've been talking about capital flows from around the world into U.S. real estate. Chris, really interesting discussion. You brought up points I didn't even think we'd venture into. I really appreciate the time and your astuteness on the subject.
Well, happy to be here, and remember, we always forget our friends in Canada. They're the single largest investors outside of domestics in U.S. real estate, and will continue to be so. But they feel like our cousins, so we don't spend as much time talking about them. But happy to do that on another visit if helped.